You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for May 7th. I'm Noah from Drake University. Here's our first story. Lewis Central School Board Reviews List of Summer Projects by Tim Johnson. Lewis Central Community School District Operations Director Jeff Carper outlined more than $800,000 in summer projects during the Lewis Central Board of Education's meeting Monday. The district will purchase 3 buses at an estimated cost of $349,500, as well as 2 vans at a cost of about $60,000. Carper asked whether the district should purchase a couple of buses with air conditioning that could be used for traveling for out-of-town activities. "The kids would appreciate that," said board member Amy Adkins. "But when we do take trips and people have equipment, it does reduce the space. Is it possible to purchase buses with an undercarriage storage?" Carper said that he make that another option for bidders to include. Major projects will include replacing the ventilation system at the middle school, repairing the bleachers on the visitor side of the football field at a cost of $51,515, the home side bleachers were done last year, repaving the front drive at the high school for $50,000, and upgrading the security cameras at the high school for $40,542. Board member Bob Hendricks recalled some paving had been done on the front drive last year. "I'd like to continue up onto the island that goes around," Superintendent Eric Nose said. Hendricks also asked about storage for athletic equipment. Carper said that storage space under the home side bleachers has been discussed at one point. "It seems like we have a lot of little buildings popping up," Hendricks said. "I think that we're looking at what we're doing on campus and whether we can store things somewhere else." Carper said that administration was looking at that possibility. Other tasks include repairing and repainting district parking spots, building more storage space, resurfacing the tennis courts, and purchasing new shelving for the Titan Hill Intermediate School Library. Electrical wiring of the press box at the stadium and the garage at Kreft Primary School, soundproofing the cafeteria at Kreft, landscaping at Kreft, replacing the back drive at Kreft, and the purchase of used cubicles for Teachers Center at the high school. A number of smaller, mostly routine projects are also on the list, including refinishing gym floors at the high school and middle school, boiler and fire safety system inspections, floor coverings and repairs, etc. Carper said that they would replace a couple older drinking fountains at Titan Hill and Kreft with new ones that include bottle fillers. Board President Doreen Scheffel said that it is sometimes possible to retrofit existing fountains with bottle fillers as an attachment and save money. Carper said that he would look into that. Altogether, the project totals an estimate of $861,750, Carper said, although the actual cost will depend on bids. Projects requiring bids of more than $10,000 always go to the board for approval. In other business, the board approved renewal for the district's Power School, Illuminate Data and Assessment, and Edgenuity licenses. The board's next virtual meeting will be on May 18th. TD Ameritrade plans to hire 275 in Omaha as online activity booms amid shutdown, by Rick Ruggles. Layoffs, job furloughs, and working from home in March have contributed to booming activity for TD Ameritrade and the need to hire more workers. As the American economy sputters through the coronavirus pandemic, Omaha-based TD Ameritrade churns with record-setting bustle. The online brokerage firm aims to hire 275 people for its Omaha team and more than 525 others for TD Ameritrade jobs in 4 other cities around the country. TD Ameritrade said that its first 3 months of this year broke records, and the company expects to remain high actively. The company cited the volatility of the market as a primary reason for the surge in action. "The demand from new and old customers is great," said spokeswoman Becky Nia. "And we want to make sure we have the staff to be able to service them," Nia said. All of Omaha's jobs, and most of more than 800 nationwide, will fall under the category of entry-level financial services trainees, Nia said. The job involves a mix of telephone and online client service. From January through March, the company had a record number of client trades, 2.1 million per day, TG Ameritrade said through its quarterly report. The prior record set in the previous quarter was 1 million, less than half of the new record. TD Ameritrade also registered a record for a net new client assets of $45.4 billion. TD Ameritrade attributed to furious activity to, among others, the volatility of the market and the fact that more people stayed home in March because of the coronavirus situation and therefore had more time to manage their investment portfolios. Further, TD Ameritrade went to zero commission trading last year, just as Charles Schwab and some other companies did. Schwab announced late last year that it had reached an agreement to acquire TD Ameritrade. TD Ameritrade interim president and CEO Steve Boyle said only days ago that the deal is expected to be complete in the second half of 2020. Despite the frantic demand for Ameritrade services, the value of TD Ameritrade's publicly traded stock fell from $52.65 per share in early May 2019 to $36.06 as of Tuesday. Financial service businesses generally have suffered during the recent stock market decline and coronavirus crisis. Boyle last month called this period unprecedented. As we've seen before in times of market uncertainty, clients are increasingly turning towards our educational resources. It goes without saying that an environment such as this has resulted in heightened client engagement. Boyle added that TD Ameritrade delivered its services last quarter in the midst of a Herculean effort to transition our workforce to a work-from-home program because of the virus outbreak. TD Ameritrade also needs workers in Chicago, St. Louis, San Diego, and the Dallas suburb of South Lake. Potential employees may fill out an online application at jobs.tdameritrade.com and then type in financial service trainee in the appropriate box. Officials declined to give a starting wage. Council Bluffs Schools eligible for $1.8 million in relief funds by Tim Johnson. Council Bluffs Community School District is eligible for up to $1,843,914 from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund for expenses related to the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the Iowa Department of Education. The allotment is part of a $71.6 million the state has received in federal funding from the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or CARES Act. Allocations to school districts will be based on each school's eligibility for Title I, Part a federal program that provides funding to districts based on the percentage of low-income students it serves. Nationally, $13.2 billion of the relief package was targeted for K-12 schools. These funds will provide critical support for schools, especially as they develop plans for what a return to learning will look like in the fall, said Iowa Department of Education Director Anne LeBeau. Schools can use this funding to address coronavirus-related challenges, including online learning support, professional development, educational technology, mental health services, and services to support students with disabilities. The application for this funding will be posted on the department's website this week, she said during Governor Kim Reynolds' press conference Tuesday. By completing the application, each school must designate how they intend to use the funds and agree to fulfill reporting requirements, continue to employ staff, and comply with other federal funding regulations, according to Heather Doe, education consultant and communications officer at the Iowa Department of Education. Allowable categories for the use of funds include, but are not limited to, coordinating emergency response with other governmental entities, supporting equitable access to core instruction for students with disabilities, activities to address the unique needs of low-income children or students, children with disabilities, English learners, racial or ethnic minorities, students experiencing homelessness, and youth in foster care. Supporting school leaders with resources to address the needs of their individual schools. Ensuring preparedness and coordination to improve coordinated responses to prevent, prepare for, and respond to the coronavirus. Ensuring continuity of learning for all students. Purchasing cleaning supplies. Training and professional development for LEA staff on sanitation and minimizing spread of infectious diseases. Purchasing education technology, including hardware, software, and connectivity that aids in the regular and substantive educational interaction between students and their classroom instructors. Supporting the mental health services and supports. Summer learning programs. And planning for long-term closures. Activities necessary for operational continuity and the continuity of services. Of the $71.6 million, 90% will be available to school districts, which will use a portion of the funds to provide services to non-public schools in the areas. The remaining funds will be used for state-level educational efforts to address urgent issues caused by COVID-19 pandemic. Allocations of funds will be based on each school's eligibility for Title I Part A funding. Title I Part A is a federal program that provides districts with funding based on the percentage of low-income students served by the district. Other areas, school districts, and the amounts they are eligible to receive include the following. Lewis Central, $241,391. AHSTW, $70,765. Fremont Mills, $36,784. Glenwood, $180,980. Griswold, $70,7200. Hamburg, $38,037. $376. Logan Magnolia, $36,581. Missouri Valley, $116,652. Riverside, $55,735. Trainer, $7,985. Tri-Center, $29,457. Underwood, $22,755. West Harrison, $42,038. And Woodbine, $39,003. Pottawatomie County reports 7 additional COVID-19 cases by Mike Brownlee. There are now 69 confirmed positive cases of COVID-19 in Pottawatomie County. Pottawatomie County Public Health reported 7 additional cases on Wednesday. 6 of the new cases are Council Bluff residents and 1 Crescent resident. They were tested for COVID-19 between May 1st and May 4th. 3 are 18 to 40-year-olds, 3 are 41 to 60 years old, and 1 is 61 to 80 years old, the department said. None have pre-existing conditions, 5 of the new cases had contact with existing COVID-19 case, and 2 are the result of community spread. All of these individuals are self-isolating at home. Of the county's cases, 31 have recovered, 35 are self-isolating at home, 1 is hospitalized, and there have been 2 deaths. Pottawatomie County Public Health said that it continues to conduct contact tracing investigations for each COVID-19 case. A part of contact tracing is assessing risk to the general public. If there's not a risk to the general public, public health will communicate directly with the specific contacts identified in the investigation. If and when a risk to the general public is identified, public health will publicly identify the location and communicate any actions the public should take, department officials said in a release. To the south, Mills County Public Health reported an additional case, an adult between 41 and 60 years old, bringing the county total to 6. Of those cases, 3 have recovered. There have been 122 residents tested in the county. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported an additional 293 positive cases. Combined with the new Pottawatomie and Mills County cases, there are at least 10,411 positive new cases. The state announced 12 additional deaths connected to the disease. The department reported an additional 2,309 negative tests for a total of 52,767 negative tests to date, which includes testing reported by the state hygienic lab and other labs. In Iowa, 414 residents are currently hospitalized and 3,803 Iowans have recovered. At this time, 1 in 50 Iowans have been tested. Elsewhere in southwest Iowa, according to the state COVID-19 website, Harrison County has 17 cases, 15 recoveries, and 170 tests. Shelby County has 13 cases, 9 recoveries, and 104 cases. Montgomery County has 1 case, 1 recovery, and 121 tests. Page County has 9 cases, 5 recoveries, and 298 tests. Cass County has 1 case, 1 recovery, and 127 tests. Monona County has 11 cases, 7 recoveries, and 129 tests. Crawford County has 103 cases, 28 recoveries, 1 death, 23 tests. And Fremont County has 0 cases and 47 tests. In Regional Medical Coordination Center Region 4, which includes Pottawatomie, Mills, Harrison, Cass, Crawford, Shelby, Fremont, Montgomery, Page, Adams, Audubon, and Taylor counties, there are 5 patients hospitalized, 4 in intensive care with COVID-19, according to the coronavirus.iowa.gov. The region has 202 inpatient beds available, 39 intensive care bed units available, and 68 ventilators available. There are no patients on ventilators in the region. Region 4 remains at 6 on the state's 12-point COVID-19 severity scale. What you need to know regarding COVID-19. Symptoms in people who have been exposed can include fever, cough, shortness of breath, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The symptoms may appear in as few as 2 days or as long as 14 days after exposure. Most people experience mild to moderate symptoms that clear up in 2 or 3 weeks. Older adults and people with existing health problems are among the particularly susceptible to more severe illness, including pneumonia. If you are sick, stay home and call the doctor before visiting the office. Public health officials recommend. Stay home unless it is absolutely necessary to leave. Self-monitor for symptoms. Call your physician if symptoms appear. Cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue or your upper arm or elbow. Wash hands frequently with soap or water. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects and surfaces. Iowans are encouraged to go to www.testiowa.com and complete the assessment. Test Iowa is an initiative designed to increase the rate of COVID-19 testing in the state. Methodist Health System is offering a community hotline and screening tool at 402-815-SICK. CHI Health has a helpline to answer questions and direct patients who may be at high risk of coronavirus illness. Visit chihealth.com for information. Potawatomi County Emergency Management Agency has a COVID-19 call center open from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday at 612-890-68, there are the last two digits there, or at 712-890-5369. For those struggling with mental health during the pandemic, YourLifeIowa.org has several resources, including a hotline at 855-581-8111 and a text-friendly line at 855-895-8398. The Hope for Iowa Crisis Hotline connects individuals in crisis with the resources to address and improve mental wellness. The hotline is available for 24 hours a day. Call 84-HOPE-4-IOWA. University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha has announced a COVID-19 screening app. One Check COVID enables users to answer a series of questions and assess their likelihood of having COVID-19. Based on the user's input, the screening app will issue a low-risk, urgent-risk, or emergent-risk assessment and guide the individual towards possible next steps. Additionally, go to pcema-ia.org, idph.iowa.gov, and or cdc.gov for more information. Axne Speaks with Mayors by Courtney Durham. U.S. Representative Sydney Axne spoke with several Iowa mayors Wednesday discussing a new bill she is proposing as well as what local impact coronavirus has had. The bill is called the Coronavirus State and Local Financial Assistance Act. Axne, a Democrat who represents the 3rd District, which includes much of Southwest Iowa, worked with Representative Peter King, a Republican from New York, in creating the bill to further assist communities' aid for finances they've lost during the pandemic. The bill sets $500 billion for principalities and states to help cut revenue losses, Axne said. The bill asks the Secretary of Treasury to set up a state and local government coronavirus relief program. With these funds, states would receive grants to receive some burdens of the states and local areas are feeling, according to the bill. Axne said the goal of the bill is to help alleviate some of the financial burden from COVID-19. With these funds, states would be given a monthly grant to assist with some losses from March 1st to December 31st in the budget. She said this method was chosen as one of the fastest ways to get money back into state and local areas' hands. I wanted to get this done as quickly as possible, and this will allow us to do that, she said. Some financial issues mentioned include hotel and motel fees, funding for previous projects with some grants no longer available, library fee revenue, as well as revenue from ambulance transportation. So far, it is estimated Council Bluffs will see a $5.2 million loss from the coronavirus by the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, according to Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh, who participated in the roundtable with area mayors. That estimate comes from a number of those staying at hotels and motels being down, red light camera funds being down, golf courses, swimming pools, and other local venues like food and drink also seeing a negative impact revenue-wise. At this point, we certainly hope the federal government will reach out and help defer some of the costs, Walsh said. As it is yet unknown how long the coronavirus precautions will last or what the rest of the year will look like, it is also unknown what the costs will arise at this point. State to reopen Iowa campgrounds on Friday with restrictions by Mike Brownlee. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources will open state campgrounds at 8 a.m. on Friday to campers with self-contained restrooms only. The department defines self-contained as a tent or pop-up camper with a portable toilet or an RV with a functioning self-contained bathroom. Walk-in campers may be registering at 8 a.m. Friday through Sunday, walk-in only, first-come, first-served basis. May 11th, reservations will go into effect. The DNR's campground reservation system will begin accepting reservations starting at 9 a.m. on Friday. All other reservations will continue as reserved beginning May 15th unless otherwise notified directly by the DNR. The department extended an apology to those who had reservations scheduled during the May 8th to May 14th time period. Those reservations will not be honored because refunds have already been issued and transactions are complete, the department said. The department said there have been an influx of visitors to state parks and expect to see the same at campgrounds. Park staff will be closely monitoring these areas to avoid gathering of groups larger than 10. Staff presence through the parks and campgrounds will remain and educate visitors to continue physical distancing while enjoying some of Iowa's most beautiful public places. Campers should also abide by the following guidelines. Visitors will not be allowed in the campgrounds, only those occupying the campsites. Campfires at the individual campsites will be limited to campers occupying that campsite. 6 occupants per campsite, unless immediate family contains more than 6. Some pit latrines are now open in busier day area uses. All modern restrooms and shower buildings, including water fountains, remain closed. Communal picnic tables and grills are open for use at your own risk. Playgrounds, day use rental lodges, and shelter houses will remain closed. Cabins, yurts, and shelter houses will remain closed. Visitor centers, nature centers, and museums within state parks will remain closed. Beaches remain open, but will not be monitored closely. Some campgrounds may be closed due to construction or maintenance issues, so please check the specific closure information below for each park before planning a camping trip. For the latest closure information for state parks, campgrounds, and trails, visit www.iowadnr.gov/places-2-go/state-parks/alerts-and-closures. The DNR highly recommends practicing physical distancing so that parks and campgrounds remain open as a viable option for recreational opportunity. Campers should assume the personal responsibility and abide by the guidelines set forth. Iowa has 68 state parks and 4 state forests for visitors to enjoy with hiking trails, lake recreation, and camping. Pence to visit Iowa to discuss reopening religious services. From the Associated Press. Vice President Mike Pence plans to travel to Iowa on Friday to meet with faith leaders to discuss reopening religious services to the public. The visit comes a week after Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said she would lift restrictions on religious gatherings as long as they observe social distancing guidelines and increase sanitation efforts, the Des Moines Register reported. Pence also plans to visit the Hy-Vee headquarters to hold a roundtable discussion about securing the nation's food supply. Hy-Vee, based in West Des Moines, announced Tuesday that it will impose sales limits on meat products because of worker shortages at meat packaging plants and increased consumer demand. You're listening to Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for May 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Noah from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Editorial. Serology tests have no value in fight against COVID-19 pandemic without meeting standards for quality and accuracy. We are being bombarded by seemingly constant reminders that common sense, at least when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, is in as short a supply as a vaccine to guard against the coronavirus. On Monday, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, under fire for allowing more than 100 commercial coronavirus antibody tests on the market without review, moved to assert oversight, saying the tests will have to pass agency muster, including meeting standards for quality and accuracy. Thank you. It's certainly about time, actually, well past time. In an effort to lessen the impact, officials said unscrupulous actors have been marketing fraudulent test kits and using the pandemic as an opportunity to take advantage of Americans' anxiety. History, not just the history of the country, but the world, is replete with unscrupulous actors who have used every malady, whether real or imagined, as an opportunity to take advantage of people's anxiety. To imagine that would not be the case with some as devastating as COVID-19 is, in our opinion, is unimaginable. This week's FDA action came after the agency was criticized, and rightly so, for a March 16th policy that allowed commercial test makers to sell antibody tests after validating their own data and notifying the FDA. The result, the Washington Post reported, based on the comments of testing experts, was a flood of products of dubious quality that confused hospitals, doctors, and consumers. What Scott Becker, chief executive officer for the Association of Public Health Laboratories, termed a wild, wild west environment. The association, which represents state and local public laboratories, urged the FDA to exert its authority over the tests. Antibody or serology tests are designed to identify people who may have overcome COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, including those who had no symptoms and developed an immune response. They are not designed to detect active infections. Some officials tout the blood tests as a way to identify people who've developed immunity and can safely return to work. At the same time, many scientists say that even for good tests, evidence is lacking that the test can prove someone has immunity for the coronavirus or for how long. Experts warn that inaccurate tests can result in serious consequences. Incorrect results could indicate people have immunity against the virus when they don't, potentially resulting in behavior that would endanger them or those around them. Serology testing is one tool increasingly mentioned in strategies to end state and local mitigation efforts. The tests are also a way to determine whether people who have recovered from COVID-19 can donate blood that can be used to manufacture convalescent plasma that is being tried as a potential treatment. But serology tests have no value as a tool if they fail to meet standards for quality and accuracy. Editorial. Giving Tuesday offers everyone an opportunity to join in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. In one way or another, there are few who have not been impacted to some degree by the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 30 million of our fellow Americans are currently out of work as a direct result of the pandemic, a number that includes 200,000 in Iowa. Millions are unable to make rent or mortgage payments. Millions more unable to afford the food needed to feed their families are seen in food lines, some that stretch for miles. These people need help, and much of that help is coming from local nonprofit organizations. From the outset of the pandemic, there have been opportunities for individuals to pitch in to help the fight against COVID-19. Metro area residents on both sides of the Missouri River have supported pandemic relief funds created by the Iowa West Foundation, the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, and the Omaha Community Foundation. The response has been heartwarming, but the needs are far from met. Today is a special day in that fight, a day in which area residents, young and old, rich and poor, can step up to help local nonprofit organizations that have been in the fight from day one and have given so much. A survey of more than 500 nonprofit leaders conducted by the Nonprofit Association of the Midlands found that more than half, 56%, reported that COVID-19 will have significant impact on their programs, services, or general operations. Many of these organizations have seen substantial increases in calls for services without having secured additional funding to provide those services. Fundraising events canceled to curtail further spread of coronavirus have resulted in the loss of needed revenue that simply cannot be made up. Any uncertainty economy raises questions about fundraising in the wake of the pandemic. Beginning today, residents of Council Bluffs, Omaha metro area have the opportunity to join a global response to the pandemic. Hashtag Giving Tuesday Now. Hashtag Giving Tuesday Now is our time to donate and to volunteer for nonprofit organizations to help ensure their continued operation, their continued necessary work during the COVID-19 pandemic and in the weeks and months in the wake of the current crisis as we rebuild. We encourage everyone to become a part in the fight to beat the pandemic and do whatever you can to rebuild the effort that will follow. If you are able, offer your financial support to nonprofit and nonprofits of your choice. For those who cannot afford a financial contribution, volunteer your services to help those who are helping others. Give blood, donate to a food bank. In whatever way you can, make a personal commitment today to be a part of the solution. Obituaries. Harriet Busey. Harriet Ellen Busey, age 76, of Council Bluffs, passed away at her home on May 3, 2020. Harriet was born May 7, 1943, in Forest City, Iowa, to the late Garland and Doris Thompson. Her father, Garland, started the Open Door Mission in Omaha, Nebraska. Harriet was united in marriage to Charles E. Busey on January 24, 1964, in Omaha, and they were blessed with children, Jesse and Susanna. Harriet worked for the Omaha Public Schools as a counselor for many years. She was a member of Christ Community Church in Omaha and volunteered at the Henry Dorley Zoo, where she was a master gardener for over 20 years. She loved her family and the zoo family, where she served as head of the zoo crew. She was preceded in death by her parents' husband, Chuck, in 2015. Survivors include son, Jesse E., and wife, Kathleen L. Busey, daughter, Susanna M. Busey, all of Council Bluffs, grandchildren, Micah and Miranda Busey, Autumn and Alyssa Gregory, sister, Carolyn Purchase of Forest City, brothers, Don Thompson and wife, Elaine of Omaha, David Thompson of Carterville, Missouri, nieces and nephews. Due to the coronavirus, a celebration of Harriet's life will be held at a later date. A private family graveside service will be held at the Plummer Settlement Cemetery. Family will direct memorials to the Henry Dorley Zoo. Charlotte Hiller. It is with great sadness that the family of Charlotte Hiller announces her passing May 3rd, 2020. Charlotte Elnora Elazin was born December 8, 1934 in her East Omaha, Nebraska home to Anna Marie and Charles Andrew Elazin. She graduated from North High School in 1952 and that same year married Harvey O. Deputy November 14th. They divorced after 30 years of marriage. She married a second time to Otto B. Hiller May 4, 1986 until his death in 1989. She worked many jobs, including a Wald's Restaurant, Brandy's, Target, and Vodek, retiring from the Glenwood Resource Center at the age of 71. She will forever be remembered by love of her children Linda and Randy Adams, Diane Deputy Newland, David Deputy, Kathy and Mike Churchill, Karen Hallman, Gail Jasek, grandchildren, Danica Adams Gillespie, Jamie Adams Mason, Joe Deputy, Alan Hallman, Michaela Hallman Cates, Shane Hallman, Sean Hallman, Rebecca Hallman, Brian Armstrong, and Marcus Armstrong. She is also survived by great-grandchildren, Colin, Aiden, and Cameron Kelly, Avery, Ethan, and Bowen Gillespie, Taylor, Emma, and Delmont Deputy, Michael Cates, Nevaeh Armstrong, and Topanga Cook. She was preceded in death by sisters, Dorothy Gravett, Florence Hefk, Eunice Shelton, Phyllis Kizelks, half-brothers Gilmer Smith and Ray Ellison, and son Paul Deputy, 2018. A celebration of her life will be held at a later date. Sports. Area golf courses adjust to COVID-19. Derek Norin. With temperatures warming up and cabin fever setting in for many, golf courses provide an outlet for people to get outdoors and be active. However, like almost everything, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the golf industry in the Council Bluffs area. While courses are still open, there are some distinct changes. In an effort to limit the spread of germs, many courses in Council Bluffs have changed their hole configuration. At Dodge Riverside and Fox Run, all cups are flipped over. While at Bent Tree, a 2-inch circular PVC pipe has been placed in each cup. Shoreline and Carter Lake has inserted foam into their cups. All these methods are in an effort to ensure golfers can remove their ball without falling into the bottom of the hole, preventing golfers from having to touch the inside of the cup. At Fox Run, patrons can swipe their own cards for no-touch payment. In general, cleanliness has been ramped up, according to the general manager, director of golf, and part owner of Fox Run, Grant Wakefield. "We sanitize our golf carts first thing every morning and after every use," Wakefield said. "Everywhere that is touched, we are using top-of-the-line sanitizer, and our bathrooms are getting cleaned with bleach and at least 3 to 4 times per day. Not that they weren't already, but we've really made a point of cleaning doorknobs just anywhere that gets touched. Because of social distancing and shelter in place, less people are out doing things. At the same time, people are itching to get outside even more. Favorable weather recently has only enhanced that, according to Owen Schuett, general manager at Shoreline Golf Course in Carter Lake. We've had a lot of nice days and very little rain, so we've been as busy as can be," he said. "We've had a really nice spring." Over at Fox Run, Wakefield has noticed a new trend since the onset of the pandemic. "We've been busy. We've seen a lot more couples out. That's been a surprise," he said. "It seems like every foursome are husbands and wives and not as many friends. There have been more couples coming out, which has been a big difference compared to any year or place I've ever worked at." Club restrictions vary from course to course. At Shoreline, guests are asked to be cognizant of a 10-person limit, while Bentry will grant access to the clubhouse for patrons to use the restroom or to pick up to-go food orders according to their website. Another common theme has been removing what Schuett calls touch point items. We advise and have signage up for people not to touch flagsticks, and we have removed all the rakes from the bunker, he said. We are washing range in a bleach solution and soap, along with spraying down all keys, carts, and all that up stuff. At Dodge Riverside, all rakes, ball washers, portable restrooms, and water coolers have been removed from the course. You can still order food and drink from their bar, but there is no indoor dining. Booking tee times online through the course website or via phone is preferred method. Shoreline is operating all sales through a window in order to minimize the number of people in the pro shop and are allowing one person per cart unless they live in the same household. We're just rolling with the CDC guidelines and what Governor Reynolds said, Schuett said. As restrictions get relaxed, some current policies may change. Wakefield says his course will soon start normalizing as guidelines change. We're about to turn the cups around here pretty soon, Wakefield said. We feel that if more and more restrictions are getting lifted, we do want golf to go back to normal. That will probably be the first things we change. To limit contact, courses are encouraging golfers to make tee times online or via phone. Each course has specific guidelines, most of which can be found on their website or by calling the course. Iowa's Chris Doyle doesn't believe players should be rushed back, by Steve Batterson of Quad City Times. Safety and wellness of the participants should guide how return to competition is structured for college football teams. As players train on their own and uncertainty remains surrounding when on-campus work will resume, Iowa Strength and Conditioning Coordinator Chris Doyle said players should not be rushed back into game action. The steeper the curve as far as getting back to training, the more risk involved, Doyle said last week during a video conference. Doyle echoed Hawkeye coach Kirk Ferentz in suggesting that 8 weeks of preparation, 4 designed for strength conditioning work, and 4 for preseason practices is optimal. Ferentz said in a video conference last month that 6 weeks is doable, but he is hopeful for 2 additional weeks as well. I remain hopeful that whenever they set the date for the start of the season, we'll have at least 8 weeks to try and get our team pulled together, and some semblance of game readiness. 4 weeks specifically for strength and conditioning staff, and then 4 weeks for more football mode. But a return to competition and the day-to-day work preceding that point in time is only a part of the equation. Doyle said that safety concerns include making certain that weight rooms, locker rooms, and training areas remain clean to help prevent the spread of COVID-19 coronavirus, which has halted all team activities throughout college football since mid-March. We're going to need to address some things from a hygiene perspective, Doyle said. There will be some unique challenges there when you bring a number of guys into a locker room or weight room. Doyle said a number of possible scenarios remain in discussion, including possibility of training and taking place in small group settings. Certainly there will be a janitorial staff available immediately upon completion of workouts, he said. We're going to need to really thorough plan, which we're currently working on. Sports medicine personnel and coaches are involved in conversations designated to return to play and return to training protocols. This is something we take very, very seriously, the safety and wellness of our athletes. That will be the forefront of our minds as we plan, and will certainly follow the directions of experts in the medical community as to how we go about it, Doyle said. College administrators have discussed multiple scenarios for the upcoming season, including the possibility of a delayed start or shifting the entire 2020 schedule into a spring schedule beginning in February. Ferentz said during a video conference that he would see no problem with a late starting season running through late December. He had more concerns and plenty of questions about a spring season that would be following just months later by regularly scheduled 2021 season. Doyle shared those concerns, including the absence of needed recovery time from the end of one season to the beginning of another. The challenges would exist there when you're looking at 18 to 22-year-old athletes playing 2 full seasons in a very short window of time, Doyle said. That's concerning. Typically, we play 12, 13 games in a 12-month period. You're talking about doubling that. He said cutting training time in half and doubling the exposure to competition only adds to potential risk. That is among the areas of discussion as to how the 2020 football season might be structured remains unknown. Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warner suggested Monday that the next 6 to 8 weeks will be paramount in determining if the season will begin on time or in early September. There are some states opening up, even as early as today, and we'll be watching closely, Warren said in an interview with Big Ten Network. Are COVID-19 incidents, are they spiking, are they stable, are they going down? He said safety of all parties involved will be at the core of any decision he makes, and conversations will include discussions with administrators, coaches, and student-athletes will be a factor in the outcome. I think as we get into the early part of June, we'll be in a position that we'll be able to make tangible decisions, Warren said, adding that he preferred to avoid any speculation on possibilities. While a lot remains fluid, there are some knowns. The Big Ten on Monday announced an extension of its previous suspension of all organized team activities for intercollegiate programs through June 1st because of concerns surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. The previous suspension, which prohibits everything from individual to small group workouts to full team activities, has been placed in place since March 13th and has now been extended twice. It is an additional measure to the previously announced cancellation of athletic competitions for the remainder of the current academic year and a moratorium on all on and off campus recruiting activities. In a statement, the Big Ten indicated that suspension would be reevaluated on June 1st. And now for national news. 33 million have sought U.S. unemployment aid since virus hit, by Christopher Rugeber. Nearly 3.2 million laid-off workers applied for unemployment benefits last week as the business shutdowns caused by the viral outbreak deepened the worsened U.S. economic catastrophe in the decades. Roughly 33.5 million people have now filed for jobless aid in the 7 weeks since coronavirus began forcing millions of companies to close their doors and slash their workforces. That is the equivalent of 1 in 5 Americans who had been employed back in February when the unemployment rate had reached a 50-year low of just 3.5%. On Friday, the government will issue the April jobs report, and it is likely to be the worst since the modern record-keeping began after World War II. The unemployment rate is forecast to reach at least 16%, the highest rate since the Great Depression. Economists estimate that 21 million jobs were lost last month. If so, it would mean that nearly all job growth for 11 years since the Great Recession ended has vanished in a single month. Even though stunning figures won't fully capture the magnitude of damage that the coronavirus has inflicted on the job market, many people who are still employed have had their hours reduced. Others have suffered pay cuts. Some who lost jobs in April and didn't look for a new one in light of their bleak prospects won't even be counted as unemployed. A broader measure, the proportion of adults with jobs, could hit a record low. The official figures for jobless claims may also be undercounting layoffs. Surveys by academic economists and think tanks suggest that as many as 12 million workers who were laid off by mid-April did not file for unemployment benefits by then, either because they could not navigate their state's overwhelming systems or they felt too discouraged to try. As the economy slides further into what looks like a severe recession, economists are going to project that the GDP, the broadest gauge of economic growth, is contracting in the current April to June quarter by a shocking 40% annual rate. As it does, more layoffs appear to be spreading beyond the frontline industries like restaurants, hotels, and retail stores. GE Aviation, for example, has said that it is cutting up to 13,000 jobs. Uber will shed 3,700 positions. MGM Resorts International has announced that their furloughs may of more than 60,000 employees could turn into layoffs. But the job cuts have hammered workers at restaurants, hotels, and retail firms particularly hard. According to the payroll processor ADP, about half of total jobs in hotel and restaurant industry, 8.6 million, disappeared in April, based on data from corporate clients. A category that includes retail and shipping shed 3.4 million workers. As businesses across the country have shut down and laid off tens of millions, the economy has sunk into near paralysis. Even as some businesses are beginning to move to reopen in certain states, factories, hotels, restaurants, resorts, and sporting venues, movie theaters, and many small businesses are still largely shuttered. Home sales are falling, consumer confidence and spending are sinking. The volume of layoffs exceeds anything Americans have suffered in such a brief period. The difference between 30 million plus unemployment claims that have been filed in the past several weeks and expected April job loss of slightly more than 20 million reflects differences in how the figures are compiled. The government calculates job losses by surveying businesses and households. It's a net figure that also accounts for the hiring that some companies like Amazon and many grocery stores have done. By contrast, the total jobless claims are a cumulative figure. They include applications for unemployment aid that began in mid-March. In addition, the government conducts its surveys for the monthly job reports in the middle of each month, so layoffs from the final 2 weeks of April won't show up in Friday's job report. They will instead be included in the May jobs report to be released in early June. After problems with state computers had slowed the distribution of federal benefits for many laid-off workers, all 50 states are now paying the $600 extra weekly benefit that the federal government included in the relief package enacted in late March. That represents a significant help to millions of laid-off workers, many of whom still remain anxious and uncertain. Jamie Stewart is renting out a spare bedroom in her home to try to make ends meet after losing her job at Southwest Florida Resort. Having applied for unemployment benefits in late March, she finally received her first payment of $1,200 this week. Stewart, a 37-year-old residing in Benice Springs, works as a concierge in the off-season and as a shift manager and bartender in the resort's restaurants. After her layoff, she deferred her car payment for 2 months and canceled non-necessities like Zoom, Pandora, and Netflix. She recently signed up for food stamps, which cover about half of her monthly grocery bill. Florida began some limited reopening of its economy this week, including allowing restaurants to serve customers in outdoor setting. But Stewart's Resort hasn't set a date to reopen its restaurants, and further reservations haven't picked up enough for them to call her back to work. "My mental health has deteriorated to a point that I don't recognize myself anymore," she said. "My eyes are swollen and bloodshot all the time now from regular moments of weakness that leave me completely inconsolable. It looks like I've aged 10 years since the lockdown started." Should you take your child to the pediatrician during a pandemic? Here's some advice by Jenny Rose Smith. It was after midnight when Leslie Rowe woke up on April 11th. Her 9-year-old son Zayden was in tears, saying that he had an intense pain in his groin. "At any other time," said Rowe, who lives in Collierville, Tennessee, "she would have headed straight to the emergency room. He was crying. He was in pain," Rowe said. "I was scared." But Rowe's family has been practicing strict social distancing since March 13th. With close relatives whose pre-existing conditions make them especially vulnerable to COVID-19, she's even limited trips to the grocery store as much as possible. Rowe called the emergency room at Spence and Becky Wilson Baptist Church's Children's Hospital in Memphis, then decided it was time for Zayden to go in. While Rowe stayed at home with her toddler, Zayden's father took him to the Children's Hospital's emergency room. Dr. Jennifer Sue, a pediatrician at Georgia's Children's Mercy Medical Group, said Rowe made the right call by reaching out to a children's hospital. "If you can take them to a children's ER, that's the best way to go," Dr. Hsu said. "Coronavirus isn't hitting children as severely as adults, or at least in our area. That means that children's hospitals are way less busy than adult hospitals." As Americans adjust to social distancing during the coronavirus, many wonder how best to care for their children's medical needs. "A lot of them are just nervous about going out because they don't want to be exposed to anything," Dr. Hsu said. "They are being very cautious, which is great." But Dr. Hsu also said that some medical issues require a face-to-face visit and doctors are taking measures to ensure patient safety at offices and hospitals. For midnight emergencies, routine care, wellness checkups, and more, here's what you need to know. What should you do during a medical emergency? For urgent issues, Dr. Hsu said parents should still call 911 or go straight to the emergency room, preferably at a children's hospital. In less pressing cases, she suggested starting with a call to a primary care provider who can help determine next steps. "Your primary care doctor is considered your medical home," she said. "Like other medical providers, many pediatricians are now offering telemedicine via phone call or telephone. If you end up going to the office or to the emergency room, calling first can help ensure you find the appropriate care." In the weeks since coronavirus quarantines have begun, Dr. Hsu said that one common problem is accidental poisoning. "Kids are getting into things while parents are trying to work," she said. "The supervision may not be the same during the day, and everyone's a little bit off their routine. Poison control is still available by phone and online through the coronavirus crisis." In addition to poison cases, Dr. Hsu said that her office has seen a lot of household injuries. Kids are swallowing coins or falling down and inside and outside of the house. Some, she said, are getting hurt while riding bicycles and skateboards. "Those injuries are normal," Dr. Hsu said, whose own daughter needed an ER visit after falling and cutting her arm 3 weeks ago. "If you're trying to work," she said, "try having a little bit of extra supervision on your children." What if your child has symptoms or is feeling sick? If your child is experiencing symptoms, Dr. Hsu recommended starting with Kids Doc Symptom Checker, a website operated by the American Academy of Pediatricians. There, parents can get reliable info on everything from stomach aches to sprains. "Let's say they have a minor fever for just a day," Dr. Hsu said. "If the child is doing well otherwise, they may be able to manage that fever at home for another day or two. The next step is to call your doctor to see what the issue can be diagnosed via telehealth or requires an in-office visit. Dr. Hsu noted that her clinic, a telemedicine call can follow by an in-office appointment within 24 hours, would likely be billed as a single doctor's visit. Despite the dangers of the coronavirus and the challenges of parenting during quarantine, Dr. Hsu said that it also means kids are shielded from common illnesses. People aren't traveling that much, she said. They're not mixing germs as much. It's a silver lining to all that social distancing and hand-washing. In the time since quarantine began, Dr. Hsu's office has seen far fewer cases of influenza, strep throat, stomach ailments, measles, and whooping cough. Managing vaccines and annual checkups during the coronavirus. With a four-month-old baby and a six-year-old at home, Lauren Bakken of San Jose, California, was concerned about risk of contracting COVID-19 at the doctor's office. Still, while her baby's regular vaccines were due, she decided that delaying would be far more dangerous. I don't know if she's going to catch COVID, said Bakken, but if she catches measles, she could die. When it comes to children who are 2 years old or under, Dr. Hsu agreed that it's essential to attend regular checkups and scheduled vaccinations. The vaccines administered at that age protect against life-threatening diseases including measles, polio, and diphtheria. Not only that, pediatricians use regular visits with children 2 and under to check vision, screening for autism and minor development in speech and walking. It's something we want to get on radar early so we can intervene if necessary, Dr. Hsu said. For some CDC-recommended vaccines, children get additional booster shots at 4, 11, and 16 years old, Dr. Hsu said. In a situation where seeing a provider is difficult or risky, Dr. Hsu said it's perfectly fine to delay some shots. There's a 1 or 2 year leeway where you can get on wait a little while, she said. The older kids who don't need vaccinations, Dr. Hsu said annual checkups can often be postponed as well. Those kids typically come in because they need to get checked out before they go to summer camp or do any sports. Those aren't happening anyway, and we feel that we can delay those. If you're considering putting off booster shots and annual checkups, it's still a good idea to check with your healthcare provider. What can you expect at the doctor or ER? When Rose's son Zayden arrived at the emergency room in Memphis, Tennessee, he and his father had their temperature screened before they got to the front desk. Both father and son were wearing masks. Leslie Rowe had been working overtime and sewed fabric masks for her community. After the temperature screening, they spent a few hours at the hospital making sure Zayden was okay. All the providers they interacted with wore masks and gloves. Those are just some of the measures that hospitals and pediatricians have put in place to protect patients and staff from COVID-19, Dr. Hsu said. We're looking to the CDC for guidance on precautions to take in the office to prevent the spread of the illness, Dr. Hsu said. That guidance includes extra sanitization and maintaining social distancing as patients arrive and wait for providers. Pediatrician offices are also following the advice from the AAP, which includes best practices for preventing the spread of COVID-19. Rather than coming to the front desk, they check in from their cars, Dr. Hsu explained. We have rooms that are dedicated to sick people that well people don't ever go in, and we're really limiting the time that they're in the actual office. With those precautions in place, Zayden got the care he needed and returned home where he's now recovering with his family. That meant that his mom could get back to sewing masks. So far, she's made 360. I just leave them in a basket at my front door for people to pick up, she said. They can actually pick them up or drop them off at our local hospital, Rose said. Beyond that, I just pray for the people that are in contact with the virus. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for May 7th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Noah from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you so much for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.